Radio Verte presents Ahuga by Corey Zimmerman.
Riff Raff, Act 1.
Last night I closed my door, same as the night before. I heard a noise and said, "Who is it?" The melody paid me a visit. I said, "Now don't get gay. What will the neighbors say?" I tried my best to act real haughty. See, but that melody was naughty.
The second the afternoon school bell rings, I am shirtless and shoeless until supper. Spring-loaded grasshoppers lurch out of the way. Jackrabbits scurry. Sparrowhawks dart. Blue jays flutter. The rare cardinal perches on a sole American elm. And a red-tailed hawk glides effortlessly about the prevailing winds. Big blue doesn't grow much in my field. Rather, milkweed, purple coneflower, and a gentler, kindler pony grass, topped with fluffy plumes of silver-green flowers that part like soft clouds in my wake as I shed my knickers and toss them on a branch at the tree line, plunging into the hickory forest carpeted with ivory, spooking a family of white-tailed deer fleeing in leaps and bounds, a buck thrashing about with fury. As upon arching limbs, ornery squirrels snicker, getting a kick out of dropping nuts on my noggin. I'm thirsty for blood, trampling down the ravine with a wild holler about a great expedition amongst an invisible war party. Big Creek meanders slowly in the valley bottom, weaving through white and red oak, and I slide down an eroded embankment into its waters muddied with rich soil. Sloshing upstream in hopes of facing the enemy head-on, I vow never to return without victory. To seize the prize or die, knowing if I am courageous, I'll be allowed to wear feathers and paint like the braves in Grandpa's books. So I carry forth, giving it my all, trudging through sticks and muck, climbing over a beaver dam, and splashing neck-high into a deep, murky pool. Dragonflies buzz, water bugs scurry, and a water snake slithers off in surprise and disappointment. Encountering the enemy, I take my life into my own hands, rushing upon the Osage as blood and guts spill out into the waters. Invisible arrows pierce bellies, and my tomahawk, a short rotten stick snapping in two with my swing, cracks two skulls in one fell swoop. An epic battle, let out a yelp, and take a scalp with an ethereal blade. Eager to return and triumph to my father, having put an end to this war. Piece of cake, I think, as I embark upon my return to my village, drums carrying on through the leaves, bumbling about as young boys do, lost in a very real figment of my imagination, mindlessly swatting the nettle, stinging my calves, oblivious to the thorns in my heels, my mind's eye envisioning dancing about a blazing fire, prized scalps, spirits held high, as the villagers foresee word of my victory. On top of the world, I know an honorable feast awaits me, PB&J with a tall glass of lemonade. But suddenly, a rustling catches my attention at the tree line, in a faint voice, and a soft song. I drop my scalps and scan the flora, tiptoeing forth through the ivy. I spot a girl, but damn, a twig snaps below my heel. Startled, she quiets, glancing back at the tree line under her thick, heavy brows, slanted deeply inward like a raven's wings that intensify the severity of her gaze. Penetrating eyes of sable brown, a circling tinge of old world blue, glossy saucers that shimmer and shine, reflecting the darkness of the thicket back at itself. Her eyes widen, and I step behind a tree. "I see you," she hollers, and I step back out foolishly. As she looks me up and down with doe eyes below her crinkled brow, a loose strand of hair curling about her cheekbone, and her long dark braids shimmering, she smiles, giggles, and a lump forms in my throat. Hot damn, I've forgotten my knickers on a branch. I quickly cover my boyhood with my hands. Idiot, laughingstock, I shout into myself. Are you acting your age? Hell no, I scorn. And she sniggers again, batting her long dark lashes. With her body ahead of her gaze, she turns with that everlasting grin, and she walks away. I wave her goodbye with one hand, and pray I'll see her again with the other. And like water off a duck's bill, a red fox darts over the horizon. Having called the game, the neighbor boys inspect two patrol cars parked outside my house. I walk past them like a ghost, and inside find my father hunched over at the kitchen table. My mother stands behind him, rubbing his shoulders. In one hand, the glass of bourbon he's trying to get to the bottom of. In the other, the head he's trying to get a grip of. A far cry from the height he'd been at breakfast. A sight for sore eyes, to say the least, deeply etching to my mind. Dear, says my mother, and after pouring coffee for the officers I now notice, as I stand with my head cocked in confusion, she pulls me by the arm to the sitting room, where I listen from around the corner, a fly on a wall, ears abuzz. And Chief Roy? Asks my father to Officer Taylor, seated across the table, young and handsome.
Well, he took two slugs, but that son of a bitch is tough as nails. Death is scared of him.
As my mother clears her throat, grabbing for a saucer from the cabinet, and a rather handsome officer squirms in his chair at the sight of her calves, saying,
Pardon my language, ma'am.
Two other officers talk shop a few feet off, custodian helmets under their arms like pumpkins they'd snagged off a porch, while Sergeant White, a short, squirrely man with no chin to speak of and a wiry mustache, stands silent in the corner, stiff as a broom, his own helmet strapped upon his tiny round head. As the others patiently sip on their coffee, he is brewing, a bead of sweat running down his temple, awaiting his moment to shine. Sugar? Cream? Asks my mother.
Why, thank you, ma'am, says Officer Taylor, as she scoops sugar into his steaming cup and then pours in the cream, and it swirls about in spirals.
Sure smells good, he says with a crooked grin and sparkling eyes that shine, lightening her own, turning up the corners, erasing the wrinkles that have suddenly formed in the past year. To say the least, the thought of aging is not easy on my mother, and she is certainly the last to realize time has been gracious. Seeing how women age quick in these parts, she remains as pretty as a picture. While most country ladies toughen up like smoked leather, my mother cuts quite a dash at 32. Anyhow, the charming Officer Taylor, dressed to the nines in his pressed uniform, made sure to eat a raw egg for breakfast and lets his tooth shine across the table for my mother. Oh, please call me Roxy, her own shame-laden smile spreading across her face as she diverts her eyes from his gorgeous grin, his chiseled jaw, which is quite pleasant to look at, before returning faithfully behind her husband, now thread-like in the spine. My father, head in his petite hand, bourbon dwindling in the other. And O'Brien? Was death scared of him as well? Asks my father. Officer Taylor loses his grin and peers down at his coffee, finally matching the moment in proper terms. And spying from around the corner, I watch my father cover his moistening eyes.
That makes all the difference now, doesn't it?
40 years old, says my father, shaking his head in disbelief. A goddamn travesty. And Edward? He asks.
Oh, I'm sure he's fine, dear, says my mother. Just a bump on the old noggin. Nothing a serving of Bess's meatloaf won't fix right up. But I notice a deepening silence, a reverence suddenly burdening the room. My stomach turns and my knees quiver, and I wonder, what about the sherbet?
Cerebral edema, says Sergeant White. While symptoms usually amount to nothing more than visual disturbance, headaches, or nausea at the most.
You gotta be joking me, says my father, as Officer Taylor closes his eyes with a slight nod of unfortunate confirmation.
Swelling of the brain, ma'am, says Sergeant White. And I'm sorry to say, ma'am, old Edward, well, he didn't make it under the knife in time.
And my mother bursts into tears and flees the kitchen with her face in her hands. And I'm left with a startling realization as she runs upstairs with a whimper, followed by a slam of a door and a sob into her pillow. Realization. So much for the sherbet. And with wide eyes buzzed in disbelief, after muttering all the possibilities, all the impossibilities, my father asks with a fist to the table, "And the bastard who killed him?" Sergeant White clears his throat, and before our eyes, his small round face brightens as the spotlight has finally settled on him. His eyebrows perk, and with the clearing of his throat, he demands the attention he believes he deserves. And in a high tenor, one gnawing at the ears, he says through the wiry threads of his mustache,
"Hank Little, getaway driver, cousin of the perp, deceased."
"No, not him, you fool. The crook who locked me in the vault." My father, thirsty for blood, as he forsakes his bourbon with fiery, bloodshot eyes. And slowly and methodically pacing back and forth, tapping the tips of his fingers together, his eyes moving stage left, stage right, Sergeant White says,
"R.C. Saunders, dishonorable discharge from the Army."
As Officer Taylor adds, "Got word on the wire, released from the pen just 2 weeks ago. Real high flyer, train robbie charges throughout the state. Appears he left his own kin to carry the can. Why the hell they let that animal out of his cage, hell if I know." And Sergeant White,
"Should have put him down like the dog he is when they had the chance."
And my father with a look of dread. "And?" And another moment of painstaking silence. "So the son of a bitch got away scot-free." "That's what you're telling me. That's an affirmative." "My God," says my father, dropping his head onto his fists. "Now don't you worry," says Officer Taylor. "His name is out across the wire, and he's bound to be picked up in no time at all." "So the son of a bitch who killed Edward, he's out there," says my father, looking around with due paranoia. And with a full body quiver, tail between my legs, a sudden zap evicts me from my body, throwing me hovering in some ambient state about the ceiling, glancing back toward life, a wayward fish on some invisible stream. I observe my own frightened puppy dog eyes, my face as white as a ghost, until he slams his fist down on the table again, and I'm suddenly sucked back into my own skull, like a fish whiplashed into a boat, and I clench my bladder with crossed legs as coffee bleeds into the white tablecloth. "That bastard stole my father's pocket watch," he manages to mutter before Sergeant White clears his throat again.
"Well, we didn't manage to find the bag of loot, other than a few bills that got loose. But,"
as he holds out his hand and with a spring of his fingers, a golden shimmer dropping by its chain. And with a tick, tick, ticking that stops my father's heart,
"Found this in the weeds off Cherry Lane."
I plop down on the exposed root of a large bur oak. I feel afraid and confused. I toss my ball into the air and let it hit the ground beside me, and my belly turns as I hadn't eaten the sandwich my mother made me. I'd fed it to a stray wandering through the yard. Looked like he could use it more than me. My father is angry, and I seize up, the ball again hitting the ground as he stomps down the back steps, letting the screen door slap shut behind him. He walks over to me and messes my hair.
"Going for a cigar,"
he says and goes to the garage. He starts the Fleetwood, grinds the gears, backs out of the driveway, and speeds up Elm recklessly. The air is relieved. The birds return, and I can breathe again. But I let the ball lay, and I peek in the back door. My mother peers silently out of the kitchen window with a hollow gaze. And with the creak of the hinges, she snaps out of it and gathers herself, straightens a towel on the sink's edge, and walks away from the ingredients for an unmade supper. With a sudden hum, she dries her tears on her apron, sniffs, and gathers herself before me, hand in hand. "Would you like that sandwich, dear? Can I go get a pop?" I ask. "Sure, dear. There's a nickel in my purse." Removing her apron, "I think I will plant some lilies." The Fleetwood zooms past Edison Phonograph, Baldwin Pianos, and the bank, and just past Frank Wright and Brother News Dealer. Its straw-colored wheels skid to a stop right in front of the beer house, beside the Bennett Ice Wagon, water drizzling out of the back, its draft horse dropping a load on the brickwork. A drunkard squat on his box peers at the shiny car through squinted eyes in the late day sun. His mind is quiet. He thinks of only drink. The drunkard, holding out his palm, hoping for a nickel from the dandy, who scoffs, peers with a sneer through his tiny round frames, and drops down the stairs which drop into the sidewalk in the subterranean darkness that awaits those in need of a smoky rumble, a murmur, a grumble, and a growl, and bursts of startling laughter, the reinforced door slamming shut on his heels, closing out all semblance of the fine summer day. Amongst the cool, musty shade, hot tempers tempered, if only temporal, over a cold one. Folding into the bar between two overalled men, a short one to the right, a tall one to the left, Mr. Olson, president of the First National Bank, my father, leans in as coolly as he might, on one elbow as the others do with the cross of the leg, one knee straight, the other jerked out. And with a hard slap of the finest thread count in the joint, the tall man asks, "Ain't you the president of the bank?" Mr. Olson, now massaging his shoulder, holds out his free hand, and the squeeze rearranges its 27 bones. "What in the hell are you doing in here? Shouldn't you be at the Brister, eating oysters, Rockefeller?"
"Ha, Lady Baltimore," says the short man.
My father, who now massages his hand, now the recipient of a rasp carrying through the smoke-choked air, asking, "Who let you out of the vault?" maintains his focus on the barkeep.
"What can I get you?"
The barkeep, in a vest and tie, bar cloth over his arm, brings a sense of civility back to my father, who orders a beer and takes a deep sigh of relief in the small oasis of civilization extracted from such austere posture. Even in an incorrigible place such as this, he knows this man's checks don't bounce. Ever. Thus, he respects him, and mightily so, amongst the chaos steadily simmering around him. Music jangles from a player piano in the back corner, as the tall man says,
"Hell, I'll settle for some pigs in a blanket." "Some poor man's cake," says the short man,
a chuckle and cough and a slap to his own swollen gut. The good old boys laugh, call him Mr. V for short, Mr. Vault for long, hovering curiously about, asking about the robbery. The good old boys, rough about the neck, hands like rope, rough about the edges, with sharp tongues that whip, slicing open flesh like a straight razor, slurred syllables, fumbling over pronunciations, and utter lack of enunciation, they ponder him aloud, and in silence from dark corners. Mr. V orders another round for the boys, and they cheer. The lower class, sitting well below the salt, farmers, blacksmiths, plowmakers, and plowers alike, drinking their drink straight up, no chaser. Men the like whom my father has never familiarly socialized.
"Whiskey," orders the tall man.
"Make it two,"
the short. Men who stand mightier than himself. My father knows these men are only as robust as their checks that don't bounce at the end of the day. And for that, he holds court. Yet Mr. V is naive that many of these fellas whisper on revenge. In hell, a mighty few are ready to rough him up a little if it comes to such. If not with words, with fists. Fists clenched in the corner below rumbling, sore lips that quiver. Soggy, swollen, wet with whiskey, trembling with rage. while others fly under false flags, seeing the opportunity to sail with a captain. As far as they see, befriending the power player, seeing the gentleman shaking on his pedestal, what the hell, why not, they wonder. Knowing downright things happen around this man, they can see in each other's eyes, mutiny, when my father looks away. And they can see it in his eyes when he glares back at them with due paranoia, fear. But with each swill, concerns dwindle, fists unclench, jaws soften, as do shadowed gazes, turning away as fellows are soon distracted by rambling means and tangents, meaningless dribbles that collect on the lip of life, disputes amongst friends and enemies kept closer. Those few believing Mr. Olson's company may accompany certain things, or rather, a lack thereof, such as evictions, bankruptcy, and bounce checks, cozy up to the president, buying Mr. V two fingers at a time, making a full-knuckled fist of it. Nickels they cannot afford to part with, let alone piss away. A wise investment as far as they see, as even they can't see but an arm's length. Leaves of grass. So amongst the drunken chatter, my father, two sheets to the wind, leans back another and orders one more round for the boys, and the boys cheer.
"Ain't gotta twist my arm," says the short man, shouting over the player piano.
"Do you know what the last dinner they served on the Titanic was?" says my father in a bibulous tone and rhythm, well whitened up with the boys. "Roast duckling with applesauce." And he's complimented with a hiccup and a side of grin.
"So you gonna put your money where your mouth is and buy those goddamn carbine rifles or what?" says the short man.
"Keep them damn crooks out of town," says a jaundiced old man with a missing tooth, wobbling in on the conversation.
The short man flings spit from his lips.
"Damn niggers and spicks too."
"Cheers to that,"
says the old man with a gummy salute.
"Goddamn darkies,"
losing his train of thought, vision dim with drink, down a gulping drain. The door opens. The light pours in, waking my father to his dread, and his eyes widen. He lifts his dropped head in anger, and the room spins in rage, and his ears ring in hate, and he sighs and slams down his mug, saying,
"You're goddamn right. We're gonna kill every crook that steps in this town."
"Hell, my wife can roast a duck,"
says the tall man. The sun sets on our hamlet, dying down for the night. The old drunkard hobbling his way down the alley in the darkness, past a veiled fence in a shadowed nook, blades shimmering just out of sight in a sliver of pale moonlight. Well bent at the elbow, the drunkard, failing to notice his own dice with death, carries on. A hack, a spit, he labors for his honest, yet homely nest of straw and wool snagged from a clothesline. Plopping down, he rubs his swollen knees and yawns, scratches his beard, passes gas, and lays his weight back into the damp brick wall with a deep sigh. But a quick yelp widens his tired eyes and sends his weary heart into a short sprint, rising to his throat for the occasion, a throat raw with drink. The yelp of pain labors him back to his swollen feet, and wearily he stumbles back up the alleyway in concern. The night quickly silent as the grave once more. And just a stone's throw ahead, he spots in a sliver of moonlight, a brown mutt lying on its side, slow to pant, laborious to catch one more moment on this earth. The drunkard kneels. The mutt looks up at him with all he's got left. Sad, teary eyes gleam in both directions. Blood oozing from a deep wound in its neck, and after one last pant, the mutt drops its head to the cool brick and dies. The drunkard strokes the mutt behind the ear, when suddenly, another faint cry grabs his ear from behind a nearby trash bin. He discovers a wee puppy and shivers, gently picks it up, as it paws helplessly at thin air. Trembling in his palm, the little creature nuzzles up in the nook of the drunkard's arm.
"Well, ain't you a sight for sore eyes," he says,
as a shadowed figure streaks past the periphery and into the night. Motionless in bed, I listen as my father double-checks the locks yet again. Click, 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 click. I tense as he climbs the stairs. I hold my breath as he's on the piss and makes his way to bed, thankfully snoring in no time. A weight off my mind. I release my breath and let the spring squeak as I bounce to my feet in my one piece. Out of the window, I spot a dark silhouette crossing the lawn below. Surely that old raccoon making its way for the trash bin again. And from their bedroom, I hear paper crinkle. My mother yearning for the social circle she had left behind, reading letters by candlelight. Dear Roxy, seeing how you have become provincial, I simply cannot fathom how you are faring without the proper necessities of life, such as theater. My mother lets out a breath of her own, just as a commotion outside startles my father from his slumber. And with a curse, he stands from bed and rummages through the closet.
Goddamn son of a...
What are you looking for? Asks my mother.
Something to bash that crook's head in. That's what I'm looking for, Roxy.
It's only that silly raccoon again, honey. You're drunk. Come back to bed.
Good for nothing, crook.
As he makes his way to my room, where I've jumped under the covers, lying stiff as a board, afraid to swallow, quilt pulled up to my eyes as he digs through my closet.
Shh, you're gonna wake Oscar, says my mother from the hall.
I'll kill that son of a bitch, he says, grabbing my bat.
Trampling down the stairs, he unlocks the front door. Click, click. I run back to my window and watch as my father stumbles belligerently about the front lawn, shouting angry slurs, venting his spleen, lashing out at ghosts, having it out with his own shadow. Bats scare from the attic, neighbors from their beds, windows light up, curtains open, and dogs yelp and howl. And I tiptoe out of my room to spy on my mother, who has retreated to her own bed.
Fine, go on and be a madman, she mumbles. I'll have nothing to do with it.
As she picks up another letter and reads,
Dear Roxy, I pity you.
In the candlelight, those words dance about in madness, a madness that has become the night. And she drops the letter and sits up on the edge of the bed, face dropped in her hands, at her wit's end, living on raw nerves, until the floor creaks and she looks up at me.
Oh, honey, did he frighten you?
No, I lie. By the time the police arrive, my father has sobered up some, and I spy from the top step as he explains he had heard someone outside. I watch as the officers bob their heads. After all, my father is, in fact, an essential pillar of the community. And yes, they assure him, his thick checkbook is in good graces, but not precisely in those words. Due to your generous patronage to the department, it goes without saying, we'll be sure to increase our tours of inspection. As my mother quietly invites the second officer, Officer Taylor, with chiseled jaw and sky blue eyes that sparkle even at night, into the sitting room. He anxiously sips on the coffee she had brewed just for him. She doesn't know what's wrong with her husband, she whispers.
Now I doubt that crook's gonna return, ma'am, but there's a lot of bad guys out there.
In a tiny little town such as this? She asks.
Ma'am, you'd be surprised.
And she suddenly looks afraid, or feigns to be.
Now you don't worry, ma'am.
Oh, please call me Roxy, she says.
I'll keep an eye on things for you, Roxy.
That'd be mighty kind, Officer Taylor, grabbing him by the arm.
As Sergeant White arrives, he motions my father to the parlor with a slight nod of his own.
Next time,
placing a blue .38 special into my father's hand,
put a hole the size of a turnip in his head.
My father takes hold of the gun and says, Is that blood on your sleeve?
It appears so,
scraping at his sleeve with his thumbnail.
Came across one of them filthy strays. Had to put that bastard down.